Ya regresamos. Gracias por escuchar a Spanglish Seminary. ¿Cómo están todos? ¿Cómo han estado? Oh, I brought the Spanish out today, right?
You did.
I didn't mean to, but we're going to have like a Spanish podcast interview. Find some Spanish.
I'm so down for that.
We'll see. We'll make it work. There's a few people on my list that we can interview that are only in Spanish. There's so much that we could do, but time, right? We need time. Time is... I don't want to say time is money, but anyways, we'll make it happen. We got so many more ideas. But this is Spanglish Seminary. My name is Juan Lopez.
And my name is Rogelio Robles.
This is my brother, Rogelio Robles. Producer Roger is what I'm going to call you. That's your official name. As always, yeah, one more time, thank you all for listening. And tell them, for those who don't know, what this podcast is about.
This podcast is essentially La Experiencia Latina in the Church, sobre the space between Spanglish y Inglés, Catholics y Aleluyas, Latin America y el Norte.
And you can find us, follow us on social media. And Instagram is
Spanglish, at Spanglish Seminary.
Same thing for Facebook, Spanglish Seminary. And Twitter's a little bit different. It's Spanglish _
S-E-M.
S-E-M, so seminary, S-E-M. And so this week we have the amazing Dr. Daniel White Hodge. He is the Associate Professor of Intercultural Communications at North Park University in Chicago. He is the Chair of the Department of Communication of Arts. He's really interesting. He has a podcast called Profane Faith, and it's an amazing podcast. Y'all should check it out. I'll tag it as well. But you guys should check out his, y'all should check out his podcast, Profane Faith. Look it up. And his research interests are the intersections of faith, hip-hop culture, race and ethnicity. And he focuses on ethnic minority young adults, and the emerging generations that are coming. I had a good time talking to him. I mean, it was fun to talk about, Tupac and Kendrick and Chance the Rapper. And, I had to ask him what his top five rappers of all time. But he really knows, he is a... I also asked him about, growing up as an Afro-Latino and that experience. So it was a really, really good conversation that we had with him. And, I could just narrate the whole thing over again.
Right? Yeah, but it was actually a really good podcast.
I'm not going to do that. So really enjoyed our time. He is an amazing professor, very wise, and doing some great work. When it comes to hip-hop theology, hip-hop and theology, and the Latino church and the African-American experience as well. Without further ado, as they say, as we always begin, we begin the same way, right? I asked him how he began his journey in the academy,
mm-hmm.
And producer Roger edited to begin there, right? So that all my banter and rant kind of got away from that, but... Hey, send us any questions, any requests, any other things. We got some stuff coming up in the works as we try to make time for it. We haven't forgot about the stickers, but we got some other stuff that we're trying to work out, some giveaways and different things that we got in the works. So we still have some, a few more episodes to go in this season. But as always, thank you all for listening. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for everything. We really appreciate. Muchas gracias por todo. Vamos a tratar de meter más español en Spanglish Seminary, right? We're gonna have to up the Spanglish level on this. Anyways, but thank you all for listening.
Enjoy.
Thank you. So. Tell me how did you end up in the academy and doing theology?
Oh my gosh. Well, it really wasn't by choice or by plan, in all honesty. I mean, I got out of high school and, I was trying to go legit. And so I ended up going into construction and stuff, man. So I built homes for a real long time, man. And I didn't go to college right after high school and stuff, man. So I just worked. Up until my mid-20s, and then I started getting involved with, I was already volunteering in the neighborhood. And then I met a couple of people, and they were with Young Life, and then they were, you know, I really got involved with that. But they were like, well, if you're going to be an area director, you know, we really want somebody with, you know, at least a bachelor's. So I decided to go back to school, got my undergrad. And at that point, I was getting ready to come on staff with Young Life. Well, and I was on staff. I came on staff with Young Life, and I was like, this is my career. This is what I'm going to be doing for the next, you know, 40 years of my life. But as always, you know, it's like, you know, what plans we lay out, you know what I'm saying? And
for sure.
I ended up getting married. I had kind of a life crisis at that time. After I got married, my community kind of like flipped it on me, and I ended up going back to grad school. I had started courses at Fuller in Menlo Park, but then I, you know, moved back down to Pasadena and, you know, finished up my master's. And right about the tail end of my master's, I was just like, you know, I think I want to teach, because I, you know, I taught high school and, you know, a couple classes here, but I was like, I think I really want to teach at the graduate level or at the, you know, the college level. And it's like, well, you better consider getting a PhD. And I was like, nah, man, I ain't no PhD guy. You know, that's that's too much money, too much work. I was like, I ain't got the time for all that. And they were like, well, look, if you really want to pursue this as a career, you know, as much as you hate it, the world sees you, you know, by your credentials. And unless you have those three letters, you know, like, you just, it just ain't gonna happen for you. And so I'm thankful I listened, and I applied, and, you know, got in, and ended up teaching. My first teaching position was at in La Puente with Isaac Canales out at LABI, man.
Oh, that's Bible. Awesome! I didn't know that. Okay, I'm actually just started last semester teaching there. I taught church history last semester, and then this semester I'm gonna teach ministry and social justice. So. Yeah, I know Dr. Canales, so that's awesome. Wow.
Yeah, that was good, man. You know, I had known Isaac from, you know, the Young Life days and seen him as his preacher, and then he was just, you know, he opened up the door and he's like, well, look, man, if you want to, you know, cut your T's and stuff, man. So this was around 2002. I started teaching there, and I was just theology and culture. I had a practicum course and stuff, man, and awesome. Yeah, that's what's up, man. That was the spot, man. And then I, you know, went from there to APU. Taught there for a long time and adjuncted a whole bunch of places. And by that point, you know, I was like fully in it and stuff, man. Started doing some writing and started doing some, you know, like I said, well, my dissertation had research and stuff, man. So, you know, I kind of just capitulated and was just like, all right, I think this is, you know, where I'm supposed to be at for now, man. And, you know, I was at the, when I was in grad school, I was going back and forth between being you know, like a community organizer and, you know, an adjunct and stuff, man. But, you know, as I got more into it, I was just like, I think, you know, I really do feel myself being, you know, I'm a fit for the academy in terms of just how I think and how I process. And plus I like summers off and stuff. So although I didn't get that until I got full time here at,
for sure,
at North Park and stuff, man. When you an adjunct, you say there is no time off. Yeah. You just got to keep teaching and stuff. So yeah, man, 2012, moved out here to Chicago and started teaching here full time at North Park University and stuff, man. So that's kind of the quick and dirty of how I got into it, man. It was really just happenstance. Like I said, I thought at one point my career was going to be construction, and then I thought it was going to be Young Life, then I thought I was going to be some organizer, and now I'm kind of like, all right, well, we'll see what happens next. But, you know, I've kind of been at this now for about 17 and a half years or so.
That's awesome. That's encouraging to hear, and just I'm always encouraged by hearing the different stories. Okay, so from that, we were just talking about your books, right? So your first book was on Tupac's theology, right?
Yes, Heaven Has a Ghetto. Yes, exactly.
Heaven Has a Ghetto. That's an awesome name. And then the second one is Soul of Hip Hop.
Yep.
And then the third one, what's the name of the third one that just came out?
Well, the third one was it was Hip Hop Hostiles Gospel. It came out last year, and okay. It's really a broader look at hip hop, looking at, you know, anything from spirituality. How does hip hop conceptualize its theology? How do we look at concepts of struggle? How do we look at concepts of evil within that? How do we look at the image of Jesus? You know, so I talk about the, you know, the hip hop Jesus and stuff. So that was that book. And then this one that just came out literally last month is called Homeland Insecurity, I have to remember the subtitle, man.
Yeah.
A hip-hop missiology for the post-civil rights context.
I'm looking forward to reading that one. I'm definitely gonna get that one.
I'll have to give you a copy, man.
Oh, that I appreciate it. And so, what led you to study the connections between theology and hip-hop? I mean, besides the obvious, if you listen to hip-hop, you're gonna hear theology within a lot of verses. I mean, we can think of a bunch of different rappers. Of what led you to merge those two together?
Oh man, and again, man, I wasn't even thinking about that. That's the thing, man. So much of the good stuff comes when you don't even set out as a mission and a plan. It's just I had grown up listening to hip hop. I worked in the music industry for a little while back in the 90s and stuff, and so I felt like I had an intimate insider's look at what hip hop is. And but then in my fundamentalist years, man, I turned away from it and saw it as worldly and secular and devoid of God. And
I went through that too.
My existential crisis, man, like hip hop was there. I mean, it was like the soothing balm of God saying, like, this is what I'm going to use to help heal you. That coincided with me going back to Fuller. And I remember taking a class with Brother Craig Detweiler. It was theology and film. And I remember going to that class. My mind was just like blown away. I was like, it was like the layers of fundamentalism were just coming off, man. And it was like I'd never seen film like this. And it hit me one night. I was just like, man, we need to be looking at hip hop the same way, man. And so that kind of started that journey. And so, started reading up. But, Noise and Spirit, Anthony Penn edited that book. Trisha Rose, kind of the first book that came out in 94 on hip hop culture, looking at that. Nelson George, Hip Hop America. So really, Bakari Kitwana, Hip Hop Generation, came out in 2005. So really started putting some of these things together. And I'm like, wait a minute, there's some stuff here, man. And so as I started my PhD process, you have to submit a proposal and everything. And I thought, I heard this TA talking about, oh, I'm doing a PhD on the theology of Henry Nouwen. And I was like, that's great. Mm-hmm. But what about we do one on theology of Tupac? And so, I wrote it up and it got approved and I started, digging into that stuff, man. And so, again, happenstance, but as I've gone deeper, hip hop is just so complex and so rich. I think, God has been working in it, for such a long time. But it's easy to overlook, right? It's like you think, oh, man, four-letter words. The misogyny, we have to deal with all that, right? I mean, you can't overlook that. But at the same time, there's a risk within it, and really, it's a hermeneutic. It's a way to interpret the Bible through it, with a hip hop lens.
For sure, yeah. I mean, as you're talking, I'm just thinking of verses, right? Of different rappers and different. For me, the first verse that I can remember that made me think about God. I mean, I was raised Catholic, but hearing Mos Def's and Talib Kweli's
yep.
Thief in the
yep.
Night.
Yep.
So that song, I think they're quoting The Bluest Eye, uh-huh. right? But just that first verse, when I would hear it over and over, I was finishing high school, I was 17, 18 around that time. And that was one of the first times that it was like, whoa, there's something else out there besides, and a different way to express it. So yeah, for sure. There's definitely a lot of work, and I'm definitely gonna write down all those books you mentioned and catch up on that for sure.
And I can send you those links too, man. Stuff, man. Yeah, that's no problem.
Yeah, for sure. I can share that with the listeners as well. I'm sure people would be interested in reading that. So talk to me about your new book. So hip hop and missiology, right? I was listening to your previous podcast, and so the missiology, people know, it's the mission of the church, right? And what is the church's role in the world? So can you tell me what that has to do with hip hop?
Well, that's a really good question, man. I mean, I think for me, really the thesis and argument of the book is like sounding the alarm. It's like this: look how bad it is. Here's what my research has said. Here is how I have seen it. And if Christianity is going to continue, I make the argument we have to embrace a hip-hop theology. So it's kind of a way of looking at, it's going beyond just the introduction of hip-hop theology, right? It's like, I felt like I did that in my first couple books, introducing it. Now I feel like, okay, let's look at it pragmatically. Let's look at it. How do we apply this to everyday life? And so I look at it by, you know, by examining Kendrick and Tupac, present a great version, a great image of what the Great Commission is and what the Great Commission talks about. And so then how do we then begin to embrace that in church? How do we begin to deal with issues of justice and social equality in our communities? How do we begin to then think about that, you know, and how the church acts those things out? You know, and it's not going to be perfect. And I think that's the thing about hip-hop. Hip-hop says, look, we're going to combine it all. We're going to combine the good, the bad, the ugly, the sins, the virtues, yeah, all of that, and we're going to deal with it. We're going to engage with it. And so for me, it was just kind of enacting that. And so really the first part of the book is looking kind of like at the, you know, the colonialism that has come about as a result of the last, I don't know, 400, 500 years of exploration, and how that hasn't really helped and has produced really crappy theology. The second part of the book kind of examines, okay, what are we even talking about with the hip-hop, you know, theological paradigm? And then the third part looks, again, looks at it pragmatically, like how do we then begin to engage hip-hop theologically in this era that we live in, the era that finds a person who is a hater of all things ethnic minorities. Now, you know, he may not say that on the cover, but look who he hires. Look what is being done. Look what is happening in the Supreme Court, the district, the laws that are going on. So how then do we enact that when, you know, 80%+ of white evangelicals voted for him and are standing up for him and are standing for a man that with values that they for long have touted as saying, these are bad, these are immoral, these are wrong, and now they're making excuses. So we have to deal with that, because those are some contradictions, right? Those are some areas of theology that I think, it was an article that came out the other day in the Post and New York Times that was talking about, you know, is Christianity a colonialist? Like, how can we begin to do this? And it's just like, you know, I know myself and folks like Daniel Camacho were saying, like, this is Christianity. This isn't just a one shot. It's just like, this is Christianity. It's like, when you talk about police brutality, it isn't just all these lone wolf officers. No, this is police terrorism. This is, and so it's looking at it for what it is rather than what we want it to become.
Right, yeah, you gotta confront it and you gotta name it. You gotta name the demon, as I say. I'm borrowing it for other people, but yeah, you gotta name it for sure.
Straight
you
know,
you were mentioning, talking about politics, right? It reminds me of Kendrick's song, The Hood Politics, right?
And there you go.
I never realized when he flips it and he's talking about Bloods and Crips and Bloods, mm-hmm. and then he says, you know, Democrats and Republicans.
Right.
And he's like, right. It's the same ideas, the same conflicts, the same, you know, strategies in ways that we get our identity, right?
Right.
I mean, there's so many places where we can take this, but one of the things for me that kind of brought me back, you know, as you mentioned, I went through that same phase, the same, you know, fundamentalism and, you know, not listening to worldly music and all this stuff. And one of the things that brought me back was Kendrick's Swimming Pools. And I was listening to that song and I was listening to the, so I've always been a lyrics guy, right? So you listen to the lyrics and you hear that this is not a song about drinking, right?
Right.
This is a song about not drinking, and it's so subversive, and it's so it was just an amazing song that I was like, all right, let me listen to this album, and that kind of brought me back, and you know, started listening, caught up on all the old Kanye records that we'll bring him up in a bit, but all the Kanye records that I missed in between that time, but yeah, I mean, Kendrick has so much, even in his new album, in the Damn album, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things for me that stands out. So there's two, right? There's the Chance the Rapper, right? Chance the Rapper's yes. theology, and Chance the Rapper's like joyful. I call other people have called it like joyful noise, right? There's this joy in his theology and his song when he brings up God. And then Kendrick's is obviously, I mean, he named his album Damn, right? So that kind of names it. What do you think about how those two fit? Like they don't necessarily even have any beef with each other. Like I noticed that they respect each other. Like would you see any connections between the two as far as like what your book has to do, maybe in connection to like Chance the Rapper?
Yeah, no, absolutely, man. I think Chance is a unique rapper, right, in the sense that, one, he was underground, he was local. I mean, you know, he used to be connected with, well, he still is connected with Phil Jackson here in the city, out at the house, you know, one of the premier hip-hop and theology spots in the country, man. I always try to point people to Phil, you know, out here, man. And so he has every year in June, he has a hip-hop revival festival, man. And Chance used to show up, man. I mean, back with Chance, before Chance was Chance, right? I mean, so,
yeah.
And his story is not necessarily the traditional hip-hop story, right? He's in touch with his parents. They tweet each other, right? He grew up in church, right? You know what I'm saying? I mean, so he has a unique perspective of combining the sacred, secular, and profane, and really the sacred and secular, in a unique way of looking at life, looking at how particularly Black religion is enacted in life. And so for me, I see that in harmony with Kendrick, because Kendrick now brings in the profane and says, okay, let's combine all of this. How do we engage with sex? How do we engage with drugs? How do we engage with the Bible? All in one sentence. And how then do we look at these things within a messed up lens? And so, and Kendrick had, you know, like literally hands laid on him, man. I mean, it was like Snoop and Dre and Watts Prophets, all these West Coast cats, man, DJ Quick. I mean, these cats came through and were like, look, we're passing the mantle on to you. And you are essentially picking up the cord from where Tupac left off. And if you listen to Kendrick in his interviews, he talks about that, man. He talks about how Tupac was a strong influence for him. He's seen, even if some of his songs he's picked up, you know, what Tupac was talking about. Like the whole, you know, you were just talking about Democrats and Republicans. I mean, that's something that Tupac was talking about back in 1993. So yeah. Kendrick is like, but I don't want to die when I'm 25. So how do I avoid some of those pitfalls? How do I avoid some things that Brother Pac fell into and was snared in? And how do I continue that, man? So I see Chance is almost like the praise and worship leader and Kendrick as the pastor, right? And so
it's
a really great harmony, man, to, you know, to have those two in concert, you know. And what I mean in concert, not the physical thing, but just, you know, theologically.
Yeah. Yeah, because you see the two, and you need both, right? You need the joy of what could be, of the already but not yet, and definitely what Kendrick does. So as an Afro Latino, right, what has been your struggle between both cultures, between, you know, Black and Latino culture, that you're living in the middle of it, right? Where for example, for me, you know, being Mexican American, you're from two countries at the same time, right? I have family in Mexico, I have family here in the US, and you sometimes feel, growing up, you feel like you don't belong anywhere. So is that multiplied for you as an Afro Latino?
Yes.
What was your experience?
Yes, definitely, man. I definitely think it's multiplied. I mean, I think, you know, on one end you have, I'll put it this way. I mean, I've always been accepted, or more accepted, in the African American community, because, you know, as I always say, race is always on display, ethnicity you can hide. And so, you know, racially, I am Black. And so I identify as that. And so I identified as that for a long time. My mom, even though she was full Mexican, she didn't fit within her, you know, family structure. You know, we didn't necessarily have the traditional Latinx type of, you know, family growing up and stuff, man. It's like my mom got pregnant with an African American man, and, you know, that was like, woo, back then that was like crazy, man. Like, and all of my aunts, her sisters, you know, in my grandmother's estimation, God rest her soul, you know, it was like they were marrying up because they were marrying somebody white, you know. And my grandmother even encouraged my mom, you know, this is what my mom told me, you know, to get an abortion. She was like, you know, you bringing this baby in, it's like, you know, you don't want a half mixed kid, even though my cousins are all mixed and stuff.
Yeah.
It's white, right? And so dealing with that, man, I think I've had a very strained relationship with the Mexican side of my family. And that hurts me, man. I think, you know, because I feel like on one end I'm accepted on one end, and then the other end I'm just kind of looked at cross-eyed like, well, who are you? You know? And so, yeah, man, it's definitely been a struggle, man. And I ain't seen my dad since 1982, so I'm disconnected, right, from my, I mean, I know my heritage broadly as a macro view of, like, okay, yes, my Black family heritage, but what is specifically, you know, who was my grandparents on my dad's side? I have no idea. You know, who were my cousins?
Yeah.
Did I have half-brothers? Did I have half-sisters? I don't know. You know what I'm saying? The only place in the country that I get treated as an Afro-Latino fully is in Miami. When I go to Miami, I know I feel like, okay, I'm Afro-Latino. I'm Afro. I get that. I get that connection, man. But
yeah.
Other places in the country, man, it, you know, it's definitely a struggle because it's like, you know, oh, wait, you know Spanish? Like, how do you know Spanish? How do you know? How do you know about this? You know, how do you know about this? You don't know nothing about this. And I'm just like, yeah, well, actually, I do. I grew up with that. You know, whether it's, you know, tamales or making tortillas by hand and maíz. I mean, and so all of those things, you know, definitely played a role, but it's not necessarily seen. And so, and then when it's seen, some people still look at me with suspect, like, you're not just this culture. You know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
I was in a Mexican restaurant not too long ago, you know, and we were speaking Spanish with the waitress, and she was just like, well, you're not, yeah, but your Spanish is just all off. It's like, no, you're not Mexican. You're not Mexican. It's like, and she's kind of joking, but I was at the same time just like, this has been the experience of my life. It's just like other
yeah.
people trying to tell me what I am and what I am not and stuff, man. So absolutely, it's a struggle. I think just now, you know, in my mid-40s, I'm starting to, you know, beginning to kind of have, you know, make some peace with that and just within myself about that.
Yeah. No, I can totally imagine, and we've brought that up in different conversations on this podcast, as far as Latinos and Mexicans specifically, and the racism and the colorism that is embedded within Latino culture. I mean, even within Mexicans and like Central Americans and just indigenous people, period. There's definitely, you know, the temptation of the things that whiteness has to offer. But talk to me about Tupac and his theology, as far as, you know, where your research took you and anything that you'd like to talk about in regards to that. I mean, it's been, how long has this happened in 94 that he passed, or was it?
96.
96, right, because Biggie was 95.
Biggie was 97, right? Yeah, they were right there.
97? Back, yeah. Okay, I'm right there, yeah. I know it was March 8th, 97. Yeah. You're right, they were pretty much back-to-back. Yeah, I mean, talk to me a little bit about Tupac's theology, and Heaven Having the Ghetto. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, the title of the book was really designed around, you know, Tupac's own song, you know, Does Heaven Have a Ghetto? And mm-hmm. So for me, it was looking at contextualizing theology and Christianity for hip-hoppers. And that's what I felt like Tupac did. Tupac was able to create space and create conversations around a Jesus beyond the, you know, the pale image of what Western society has presented, right? This kind of blue-eyed, blonde-haired image of perfection. And Tupac would say that, you know, that's not been my experience. That's not been the people I know experience. And more importantly, how could Jesus be that if he came from this part of the world? And so asking those questions and then placing that into context of rape, incest, depression, anxiety, suicidal tendencies. I mean, Tupac is dealing with all of these things, and he's dealing with it in such a way that it helps people identify that they are not alone. They are not the only ones struggling with this and stuff, man. And as I was, you know, interviewing people and talking with them, man, so many folks were just like, man, I understand the Bible better because of Tupac. I understand who God is better because of Tupac. So Heaven Has a Ghetto is really more of, not necessarily in the traditional sense, but it's really problematizing the images and the concepts that we have of Christianity as given to us by, you know, white colonialists. And asks, where is our space? If God really is for everyone, where is our space? And so that's kind of what I talked about, you know, in my first book and stuff. Man, in fact, I got another book coming out here with Whippenstock, Baptized in Dirty Water. And so hopefully that'll be out here this next year. And that looks a little bit more specifically at, you know, at the life of Tupac. Who was he? you know, hot, you know, what were beyond his music? Like, what did he, you know, what did he journal about? How did he, you know, aspire to be something big? You know, how did his mom influence who his life was? You know, what about his half brothers and, you know, his sisters and whatnot? I mean, he wrote songs about them. He had, you know, poetry connected to him. And he had such a huge heart for the community. I mean, people that I talked with, who had lived with him and been like, look, his house, like, yes, he started getting some money, he moved into a better house, but it's like his house became like a freaking halfway house, man. It's like he's helping people. He's bringing people along, you know, almost to his demise, right? So for me, I'm just like, huh, that's interesting. I mean, to hear that, because as even when Pac was alive, that was not the image I got from the media, right? It was like, oh, he's a, you know, he's an outcast, he's a rebel, and this and this and that. So really studying him and understanding him was really important. And so that's kind of what I've tried to do with it. I think missiologically speaking, or just from a Missio Dei perspective, like, you know, what is the mission of God? I think Tupac represents a lot of folks that are there, who have a critical insight, who are knowledgeable, who question, you know, who push back and ask the question, you know, where is my space in heaven? And so that's kind of, you know, and again, in a real quick nutshell, just essentially what I'm trying to get at with him.
No, and I'm sure, I mean, the word martyr has been brought up in conversation that I've heard just over the years, you know, talking about Tupac and Biggie. And I think that definitely changed hip hop, you know, both of their deaths and their connection. And every time you hear about Biggie, people think about Tupac. And every time, you know, it's like their lives are kind of interconnected because of the whole East Coast, West Coast beef that occurred during the 90s. So there's definitely a lot to learn. I mean, even the phrase "Only God can judge me," right? That he had tattooed, like that forces you to, even for me in high school, as a young kid, you hear that for the first time and you're thinking, well, what does that mean? It forces you to think theologically, right? What does that mean? Only God can judge me. What is judgment? Who is God? You know, who is this God that judges, and does he judge? So yeah, it definitely automatically, you know, forces you to think theologically. Especially because he was, you know, he was so popular.
Right, right.
So when you were mentioning your about his struggles with his house, right, it reminds me of Kendrick again, right, and him wrestling with the fact that he had money and had to move. He moved out to a better house, right, and so now he's out of the community that made him. And I mean, he wrestles in both of his albums with that. So definitely the connections. The connections you mentioned are there for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the question that I've been wanting to ask. So I want to hear your top five rappers of all time for you.
Top five rappers, man. Oh, jeez. Yes. Yeah. Well,
it's an unfair question.
At
but,
least
you
say top five, man. You know, most people say, "Give me your top rapper ever," and I'm like, man, I can't give you just one.
Yeah, you can't.
I definitely love MC Light, man. I mean, I think what she brought to the table. You know, I saw her in concert, man, back in the 90s, man, and I was just like, wow, this woman, you know, she could throw down, man. So she's really an amazing, you know, gifted MC, man. I mean, she really was. She embodied what the MC was meant to be, you know, back in the day. You know, Tupac, I think Tupac didn't necessarily have the flow and the style, right, the prose of what MC Light was doing, but the rawness of what he was talking about, man, the sheer gut level. I mean, that's, you know, that was something. You got to give it up to Nas. I mean, Nas is amazing in the way he flips things. His Illmatic. I mean, that was, you know, that's a, let me see. Oh man, I think probably Rakim. Rakim was really good, man.
Okay.
He was well, still is. I mean, you know, that brother, he just a lyrical genius, I think, you know, and putting his stuff out there. And, you know, the way he did it and the music that he put behind it, the beats at that time were so simple, and the emphasis was on the lyric. The emphasis was on how are you going to really be able to do, like, the beat can't save you, right? You've got to come as an artist.
Yes.
You've got to come as an MC. You can't be, you know, you can't go in there with a bunch of electronic stuff. You got to come as an artist, and that's what I appreciated about Rakim. And then I have to give it up to Lauryn Hill, man. I mean, Lauryn Hill and her premier debut album, man. I wish you would have done more, but I get it. You know, I won't get into all that, but I get it. I get what happened. But that album, man, is powerful. To this day, it's still powerful, man. The stuff that she talks about, relationships, God, sex, sexuality, you know, telling the truth, honor. Again, not the flow of a Biggie, because I would consider Biggie in there as well. Absolutely, you got to put Biggie. I'll get to him in a minute. But she really had a space and place for young people to this day to connect relationally and theologically, man. And so you can't overlook that, especially as somebody who's spitting that type of stuff, you know, because she's rapping and singing. And of course, I got to say,
even her MTV album, the live one, that one's theologically rich as well. So yeah, that's exactly. Two. Okay, and I didn't mean to cut you off. What were you
going to say? No, that's good. I was going to say my last one would just be Biggie, man. I know that's more than five, but you know, I got no Biggie.
That's
man.
Fine. You got to
give props where props is due. He did what it took Tupac in, you know, 8-9 albums. I mean, he did in, what, 2 or 3 albums, you know, just his funeral was unbelievable. I mean, you know, you can just Google that right now. I mean, you can go look and type in Biggie funeral and just see. I mean, he was treated like a freaking presidential, you know, a person that had been assassinated, man. I mean, so that's powerful stuff. That is real powerful stuff. And, you know, and the way he flowed, I'm like, gosh, dogs, bro. That's amazing. Real talent.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, he's definitely in my top five. I mean, but you know, I have conversations with other friends, and they're like, you gotta put Tupac and Biggie outside. Like they've reached the level of where they're outside of the top five, right? They're just above all that. But so it gives you space, you know, for two more there. But for sure, one is you're talking about albums that are still relevant, and one album is Mos Def's Black on Both Sides. That for me was so influential growing up as well, and right on par for me with Lauryn Hill's Miseducation album. But yeah, his album is really good as well.
And he's a good MC as well, man.
Yeah, he's good. And, I mean that album I still play it to this day. So he's in there on my list for sure. Oh man. Well, I mean, we can definitely keep going for hours. I feel talking about all this and so yeah, I just you know, thank you for appreciate your time. Appreciate, you know, the work that you do on the podcast. I'm definitely learning so much from you on the work that you do, and your voice has definitely been influential for me. So someone that I just started, I'm barely on my second season of the podcast. So appreciate the work brother.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you as well, man. I was turned on your podcast by a friend of mine, David Jaime's out in LA, and he was like, dude, you gotta listen to this, man. And so I'm a listener as well, man. So thank you. I appreciate what you guys are doing and how you're putting it together, man. I mean, I think more of our voices need to be out there. So thank you as well, man. It's an honor to be on.
Oh, but thank you. Thank you for those words as well. So any last words? I'll give you the microphone, and you can say whatever you'd like to say to the people. What do the people need to hear?
Man, I think, you know, it's a dark night right now, man. I think we have to take hope in each other. I think we have to take hope in the small victories. We may not, like, you know, like King said, you know, I may not get there with you. We may not get there with you. You know, there are slaves that were enslaved in 1780 and never saw, you know, what would happen 140 years later. And not that it's necessarily that much better, but at least it's not that. And so I think we got to take hope in what we can, be encouraged with progress we have made, and continue to fight and push forward.
Amen. Thank you, brother. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. It's been a pleasure as well. Bye-bye.